From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the week in review, including Massachusetts Senate President Stan Rosenberg, caught up in claims that his spouse allegedly sexually assaulted at least four men.
The last 24 hours have been heartbreaking and difficult. I've spent most of those hours processing those allegations.
Also today, the auctioneer who helped uncover Andy Warhol memorabilia not seen for three decades, they found it in a Massachusetts attic.
It was fun, to find these things in an early house in Avesbury, Massachusetts is quite, astounding. That doesn't normally happen.
Plus, science is showing us that ocean water is becoming increasingly acidic. So we'll go to the Institute of Contemporary Art, where one artist is showing visitors how this change affects a tiny little organism that gives us half of our oxygen. That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Friday, which means it's time for the Week in Review, and we will talk about the continuing avalanche of claims of sexual assault. Just yesterday, the Boston Globe online, and then today in the paper, published a story including claims that Brian Hefner, the husband of Senate President Stan Rosenberg, has sexually assaulted, allegedly, four men over the last 2 years. Governor Baker says he's appalled by the allegations.
They're disturbing. They're distressing, and I really felt for the people when I read the story who came forward.
Hefner allegedly groped three of the men repeatedly and forcibly kissed one over the past 2 years. Several of the alleged assaults happened at or around work events, but none at the Statehouse itself. Rosenberg says he's going to speak with reporters in about 20 minutes to address the allegations. We'll go to his statement live when he makes it. But in the interim, he said in a statement yesterday that this was the first he had heard of the allegations against his spouse. So let's hear from this week's panelists on their thoughts. John Carroll is a professor of communications at Boston University and senior analyst for WBUR. Good to see you, John.
Good to be here.
Also with us is Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and a regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinions page. Tom, it's good to have you back as well.
My pleasure.
All right, your first thoughts on the immediate future as you see it for Senate President Stan Rosenberg, John.
Well, first of all, big shout out to Yvonne Abraham of the Boston Globe, who not only broke a couple of weeks ago a story about the overall atmosphere of harassment on Beacon Hill, but broke this one as well.
A very thoroughly reported story. She spoke with the four men about their claims and 20 others that they know to corroborate them, et cetera. So she did her homework.
Right. The only people who wouldn't talk to her were Brian Hefner and Stan Rosenberg.
Yeah.
They did release statements which were pretty tin-eared, actually. I think that the statements didn't help them. They seemed really evasive and lawyered up. And I mean, I guess that's what you would expect in a situation like this, but it certainly didn't help.
Well, so how damaging is this, the claims, to Senator Rosenberg, Tom?
Devastating. And I really think it calls into question his ability to serve effectively as president of the Senate. And we may very well hear something along that lines when the press conference happens. I know that there is the argument out there that, look, this was not the Senate president himself. It was his spouse that was engaging in these actions. And the Globe story made clear that at least there was no evidence that Rosenberg was aware of it. On the other hand, Rosenberg had promised quite some time ago, when there were a whole bunch of other issues with Hefner relating to his bragging about his influence in the Senate and over the president, that he would have a firewall between him and Hefner. Clearly, that firewall has been breached multiple times. As part of really the reporting of this story, it was quite clear that the people who had been assaulted firmly believed, and the evidence was clearly there, that Hefner knew what was going on within the very secret confines of the Senate.
Yeah, so this is a very complicated story because, to your point, Tom, I mean, we're talking about allegations against the spouse of the Senate president. But on the other hand, as was reported by Yvonne Abraham in the Globe, at least two of the incidents, the victims say Stan Rosenberg was either seated across the table or in the same car where the incidents took place. So I don't know. Like, I was trying to put myself in situations where I've been across the table from someone. It stretches the imagination that he didn't know anything was happening.
Right. Was there a see no evil, hear no evil kind of mentality?
Yeah. But we can't know for sure, though. I mean, until Senator Rosenberg speaks at 3:30, because, again, all we have so far is a statement to the Globe where he says he had no idea until Yvonne Abraham asked him about it.
Right. And the other aspect of this is these four alleged victims were reluctant to come forward because Stan Rosenberg is president of the Senate. And that's at the very heart of this story. They didn't come forward until the Globe sort of brought them forward. And so one of the questions is whether you have a special investigator or not looking into this. You know, will people be willing to be forthcoming with a special investigator if Stan Rosenberg is still there in the Senate president's seat?
Yeah. Well, I want to play some more tape here because, speaking of an investigator, Senate Minority Leader Bruce Tarr, who is actually helping to structure some kind of investigation into these allegations, told the State House News Service today that it's too early to say, he believes it's too early to say, whether Rosenberg should step down.
The Senate president needs to carefully think about how other circumstances in his life may affect his situation here. And he certainly has demonstrated time and again that he cares about the Senate in a very deep way. So I'm confident that now he's evaluating what this will mean for that commitment to the Senate.
So I want to get back to something that you were saying, Tom, earlier about this firewall that Rosenberg had promised to put between his spouse, between Hefner and the work that Rosenberg's doing in the Senate. Because, I mean, let's just remind ourselves why he said he had to do that. It wasn't just that Hefner was making claims about what he could do as the spouse of Rosenberg. But, you know, he was also associated with some pretty terrible tweets when Therese Murray was the outgoing Senate president. And so it's a particular pattern of behavior, I think, we're seeing, and it makes you wonder why that firewall, if these allegations are true, wasn't as robust as possible.
I think that's right. You know, and Tarr is certainly right that, you know, Rosenberg is an incredibly decent man, and he really is a guy who cares deeply about the Senate. And yet it has been clear for years now that with respect to Hefner, his judgment is simply lacking. And it was lacking several years ago with the whole Murray tweets, and it seems still that judgment's lacking.
Go ahead, John.
Yeah, and one other sort of dimension of this is people in leadership need to have some kind of moral authority. And I think that Stan Rosenberg, maybe through no fault of his own, has a serious dent in his moral authority at this point. And I think it's very hard for him to exercise that kind of oversight of the Senate in the position that he's in. So I think there are a number of different dimensions here that really call for him to step down.
So I hear both of you saying that. I'm not sure I'm quite there with you yet, because the complexities of this particular case, I mean, I take your point about moral authority and the firewall. I still also wonder whether or not, and only an investigation can show this, whether or not perhaps there were actual effects on policymaking on Beacon Hill. I mean, who knows? But, you know, one of the things that really struck me in Yvonne Abraham's reporting when the four victims spoke to her is almost every one of them were saying that there were so many reasons for them why it was hard to come forward. And one of them was that they were fearful of damaging Rosenberg because they believe in his progressive agenda.
Right. And that complicates things as well. But I don't think that mitigates anything. And I don't think it overrides any of the other considerations. I think the other considerations are much bigger. And if Stan Rosenberg is indeed proven to have been unaware of what went on, you know, the vindication will restore something to him that that I think has been taken away from him right now.
I want to play one more piece of tape here. This is from Democratic Senator William Brownsberger. He told WBUR yesterday that one of the remaining questions for him is how the allegations against Hefner may or may not relate to the Senate itself.
In my experience, the Senate President's husband has not been part of the operations of the Senate at all. I mean, you run into him on social occasions from time to time, but the Senate's business I've not seen involvement by him. And so there's a separation there as far as I've seen it. I guess we need to hear more of what's coming out.
And maybe we will hear more about that later. But gentlemen, I want to ask you something, because there's the tragedy of what happened allegedly to these four men, and also just, you know, again, tip of the hat to Yvonne Abraham, all the other people who she's reported on in the past several months. But the thing that really struck me about her story today is that every single one of these people, and, you know, we even talked to a victim about a month ago for a separate story, but everyone says they felt like they had no recourse. They had nowhere to go. Who were they going to talk to? Were they going to talk to the office of the legislator whose aide or whomever allegedly did this to them? Were they going to go to, I don't know, who? Like, literally, there's no system on Beacon Hill to handle these things. And so, therefore, no matter what happens with Stan Rosenberg, what's going to change on Beacon Hill to protect staffers, lobbyists, fellow legislators from each other?
So my understanding is that within the Senate, sexual harassment allegations end up being referred to within the Senate. The House actually treats it differently by actually farming them out to independent investigators, independent law firms. That could certainly be one improvement.
Another suggestion that some have made is to set up a human relations office that would be independent, that people would have confidence in, that they could go without reprisals to report these kinds of incidents. But this is something that's not restricted to Massachusetts. The U.S. Congress has a horrendous system that basically forces people who are making charges of this nature to continue working with the person that they've made charges against, and they stretch it out for months and months and months. So I think there's a lot of people who need to reassess their procedures, but I think in Massachusetts it's a little more it's just as pressing as down in D.C.
And it seems to be an area that I was just going to say that concrete improvements can be made.
They can be, but I think actually even more important than institutional changes is kind of the cultural change. And it is a cultural change that I guess arguably began with Weinstein, and it is kind of epitomized by the Me Too. And what you are seeing now, I mean, we've just seen a wave, a tsunami of this stuff across the country. And this stuff that's coming out about Rosenberg and Hefner is part of that wave. People are getting greater confidence in coming forward with these stories.
Yeah. So to that point, just in case anyone forgot, we also had another major story about allegations of serious allegations of sexual assault with a high profile playwright associated with Massachusetts, Israel Horovitz, who's the founding artistic director of the Gloucester Stage Company. The New York Times, just this week, also this week, published a story that nine women had come forward using all their names. They were that confident about their allegations that they had been sexually assaulted or harassed, and in one case even allegedly raped by Horovitz when he was at the Gloucester Stage Company. And here's the thing. So this report comes out this week in the New York Times. The same thing roughly was reported back in 1993 by Bill Marx, who was then with the Boston Phoenix. And we spoke with Bill Marx, who broke the story a quarter century ago.
Would anyone be surprised if there wasn't other things like this going on in the theater community today? And I think that this should be looked into, and there should be a more active approach to what's going on, rather than having it happen again. You know what I mean? And another 25 years before we actually become concerned enough to actually do something about this.
John, your thoughts?
Well, first of all, there's no bottom to this well. I mean, any place that you have men in power, you're going to have this kind of abuse. You're going to find it virtually every aspect of the culture. But I think this is also a shift in the balance of power. I mean, 25 years ago, the Gloucester Stage Company was free not to take the allegation seriously.
Well, and even turning the back on the women making the
exactly.
allegations.
Now they're not free to do that anymore. Nobody is free to do that anymore. And people are taking quicker and quicker action all the time. I mean, Matt Lauer was gone in a heartbeat from NBC because basically the atmosphere, the landscape has changed so dramatically that really the benefit of the doubt has shifted to the accusers as opposed to the accused.
Hmm. Well, to Bill Marx's point, hopefully we won't have to wait another 25 years before we make even more progress. But as we mentioned at the top of the hour, at about 3:30, so in about another 10 minutes, we're expecting Massachusetts Senate President Stan Rosenberg to make some kind of statement about the reports of allegations that his spouse has sexually assaulted and harassed at least four people. So when that happens at roughly 3:30, we will go to that. But John and Tom, while we wait, let's turn to other big news. This is going to take us to Congress in Washington, to the Senate, where senators are barreling forward to maybe taking a vote on their massive tax overhaul package. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is saying that he thinks he has enough votes to pass the $1.5 trillion tax package. And this is him yesterday. Or actually, I'm sorry, speaking on the Senate floor yesterday, Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer had this response, some criticism of the legislation.
The increased deficits caused by this bill will cannibalize support from everything we know is essential to economic growth and a strong middle class, including support for our men and women in uniform.
Okay, Senator Schumer, point taken. But on the other hand, Jeff Flake of Arizona, Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, John McCain also of Arizona, and perhaps Susan Collins today saying they're probably going to vote yes. So it sounds like the Senate plan may be close to passage, Tom.
I think the Senate plan is going to pass. And then it's going to go to committee and we'll see what comes out of that, because the Senate and the House versions are obviously very different. I think, you know, the key impetus for this has been the cut in the corporate tax rate, which I personally think actually is really a smart idea. The problem is, how do you pay for something like this? And that's where we're now getting, you know, things like state and local taxes, income taxes are now not going to be deductible. Healthcare expenses won't be deductible, and a variety of things like that that are really going to hammer a lot of middle class folks. At the same time, you're also getting the estate tax being wiped out or potentially wiped out. Alternative minimum tax either is going to go away or is just going to be at a much higher level. So quite frankly, it also looks like we're going to increase the deficit dramatically on top of that.
And you pay for it in 10 years maybe by cutting Medicaid and Social Security.
Right.
Who knows? I mean, John, here's my issue with this. There are really great policy debates to be had about the relative merits of any one part of this tax plan. We should be having them. We did that in 1986, right? There was like a bipartisan hearings-based process. Regular order, as John McCain would like to say.
That took years.
Yeah. Gone.
Right.
Nothing. $1.5 trillion bill. No process whatsoever. That's democracy today.
There are no economic principles underlying this tax cut at all. And it's not tax reform. It's a tax cut. You know, you don't have to be partisan to feel like it's totally insulting the way the GOP has sold this. You know, Donald Trump's going around saying he's going to get hammered by this when it's actually a billion-dollar windfall for his family. Steve Mnuchin, the Secretary of the Treasury, has gone and said not only will it pay for itself, but it'll also pay down the debt. The national debt, which, I mean, the first part is blatantly dishonest. The second part is hallucinogenic. So, you know, they have gone and sold this to the American public as something that it is not. Just two statistics really quickly. 62% of the benefits of this tax cut or this tax bill go to the top 1% of Americans. And the other one is, over the course of 10 years, people making from $40,000 to $50,000 will pay $5.3 billion more in taxes than they would without this bill. And people who make more than $1 million a year will pay $5.8 billion less in taxes. So this bill is basically a Trojan horse. It's reverse Marxism. You know, you're basically redistributing money from the bottom up.
But trickle down is supposed to be good. I mean, Steve Mnuchin didn't deny that it's trickle down.
It is supposed to be good. But here's kind of the problem. The heart of this is an argument that you need this tax cut or tax reform or whatever you want to call it in order to be able to increase economic production, that it's actually going to boost the economy. There's a really interesting piece out from the Wall Street Journal either yesterday or the day before that was about an analysis conducted by the Congressional Budget Office about the state of the economy. And basically, the U.S. economy right now is acting at full throttle. We are literally at our maximum theoretical potential in terms of economic growth. In other words, it can't get better than it is right now. We really are essentially at full employment, at full use of our capital assets. So what's going to happen with this is not going to be to boost up economic activity any more than it already is. It is going to, however, benefit a lot of people who will have more money in their pockets, primarily people are better off.
Yeah. You know, there are parts of the plans which I think, you know, again, taken in isolation, good ideas, like the capital expensing parts, like allow businesses to expense immediately. I can see advantages to that because the concept there is just to get businesses to actually make investments much faster. But again, the thing is like this is there are so many different parts lumped together in a 500 plus page bill that it's turned into this chimeric monster that, again, no one really has a chance to understand. And none of the numbers work out. I keep coming back to that. If you believe in your plan and you really think it's a good one and your own formulas that you've always wanted to be applied to economic analysis, to bills, supports it, there should be no problem. But we have opposite land here.
Yeah, right. This is a Christmas plan. I mean, there's a lot of goodies under the tree. It's going to pass, and we won't even know what's in it, and we're going to start finding little goodies and weird things out there we never knew were in this.
There's two things we know. One is that trickle-down has never worked. There's no evidence that it has ever worked. And two is anything that the GOP is promising corporations will do with this tax cut, they could do now. They are flush with cash. And the reason this tax bill has 25% support in the country is that when you go tell workers, you know what, your boss is going to get a windfall and you're going to get a raise, they dismiss that out of hand because they know that's not true. Hmm. And traditionally, historically, what's happened with these windfalls is they buy back their stock, they increase their dividends.
I was going to say shareholders benefit.
And they invest the money, and it never gets down to the working class.
I would actually be really enthusiastic if this was coupled with an increase in the minimum wage. I could see that would be an interesting pairing.
Yeah.
Yeah. You should live so long.
I was like, and what are you smoking? This week also, the New York Times actually had an excellent analysis, a big picture analysis of the GOP's attempts to reform the tax code. And really what their take was that this is a picture of how the party wants to change American life. That's the way the New York Times put it in its analysis, because when you look at parts of, like, you know, the changes in the tax plan around higher education, taxing the endowments of universities, perhaps not making tax deductible tuition and fees, things like that. That's one part that came to mind. What do you make of that assessment, that it's a wholesale change to sort of fundamentals of how we pay for things we value in this country?
This is a reflection of the anti-elitism of the Trump administration and MAGAnomics, as people call it. This is basically sticking it to the East Coast elite. And when you look at other aspects of this, you know, eliminating state and local property tax or tax deductions, that kind of thing. I mean, this is a class warfare kind of bill. And I think that the colleges are, and, you know, I teach at BU, so take this with a grain of salt, but I think colleges are going to be really hurt, and especially lower income students who rely on college endowments for tuition assistance, they're going to be hurt as well. So the whole idea is that we're going to go get the affluent and the upper class. That's going to backfire in many ways because of the law of unintended consequences.
John's pulling no punches here, Tom. What do you think?
So I'm more skeptical, I think. I think there's a lot of good theoretical rational arguments for eliminating a lot of these deductions, to be frank. State and local tax, income taxes, for example. I mean, why is it that we basically have the federal government
subsidizing yeah.
state and local income taxes? The mortgage deduction, all right, that has been, you know, there's been a fair amount of data out there that suggests that really all it did was increase the price of homes. So I understand that it's having It is, you know, clearly by impact is affecting more Democratic states than Republican states. But there are good theoretical arguments for it. And what would have been nice in something like this is to really explore those thoroughly. Maybe just get rid of all deductions, actually have a relatively straightforward tax. But instead, this is riddled with a lot of different pieces.
Well, so here's my thought on that. Yes, theoretically, a lot of it is nice, but this bill is pushing those theories into fantasy.
That's absolutely
the numerical fantasy.
And
yeah.
People have made decisions, have made significant decisions in their lives based on the system as it was established. And as much as business wants stability and predictability, so do people generally. And they've made these decisions, and now they're going to be penalized for the decisions they made under the old rules.
Yeah. So we are talking about the Senate tax plan in Congress in Washington while we await Massachusetts Senate President Stan Rosenberg, who's due to make a statement any minute now. I'm seeing that they've set up a podium outside the Senate President's office on Beacon Hill. They've got microphones ready, but Stan Rosenberg has yet to make an appearance. So let's turn now to issues at Boston Public Schools. And speaking of taxes, but gentlemen, if I have to sort of cut in, if Stan Rosenberg starts, forgive me in advance. But so at BPS, BPS is under fire this week because an IRS audit, again, taxes, death and taxes, right? The two things you can't escape, found that BPS used student activity accounts to pay employees for extra work without reporting that income to the IRS. So that basically meant that BPS employees were not paying taxes on that income. And by the way, it's not legal to use those funds to pay for employee salaries. So, John Carroll, your thoughts? And we just discovered this.
Yeah,
lo
well,
and behold.
All due respect to Superintendent Tommy Chang and Mayor Marty Walsh, this whole school activity fund is a smokescreen. That was the city of Boston cut a check for almost $1 million to the IRS, and $700,000 of that was in unpaid Medicare taxes or withholdings. So it's $30,000 out of the student activity budget. And Marty Walsh is saying, we're going to go audit all the student activity budgets. Again, you know, it's a smokescreen. It's a dodge for what really happened there. And I just want to say one more thing. Marty Walsh said he only found this out last week. The city of Boston cuts a check for $1 million, and the mayor doesn't know. I'm really surprised at that.
Yeah.
Well, it looks like we have Senate President Stan Rosenberg speaking now.
Well, the allegations reported in the Boston Globe. Anytime there are allegations of sexual harassment and assault, we should all be shocked and devastated. Our hearts must go out to anyone who has been hurt, and I encourage anyone, anywhere, anytime to come forward. We in the Senate maintain a zero-tolerance policy to sexual harassment, and will always encourage people to come forward to any authority they feel comfortable with without any fear of retaliation. My heart goes out to anyone who may have been hurt, and I'm committed to helping anyone who's been harmed. This has been the most difficult time in my political life and in my personal life. As Senate President, my concern is for the senators, the staff, and all those who have business before the Senate. I've repeatedly made clear that Brian was to have no influence on what happens in the Senate. He has no influence over policy, the internal operations of the Senate, or any Senate-related business. If Brian claimed to have influence over my decisions or over the Senate, he should not have said that. It is simply not true. And I'm looking forward to fully cooperating with the investigation and look forward to their findings. And I'm confident that the investigation will find that Brian had no influence on the workings of the Senate. Brian is seeking professional help for alcohol dependence, which will include his being admitted to an inpatient treatment center very shortly. The last 24 hours have been heartbreaking and difficult. I've spent most of those hours processing those allegations, and I will continue to do so even as Brian prepares to enter treatment. And as you know, I never hesitate or shy away from questions, but today, because of the imminent investigation, I've been advised not to answer any questions at this time. Thank you.
Mr. President, can you effectively leave the Senate?
That's Massachusetts Senate President Stan Rosenberg. They're giving a statement responding to allegations that his spouse, Brian Hefner, has sexually harassed or assaulted at least four men in the past 2 years. You heard Rosenberg say there that his spouse is going to be seeking help for alcohol dependence in an inpatient facility, and that this has been the most difficult time in Rosenberg's political and personal life. Let's just take a minute here and go to WBUR's State House reporter Steve Brown, who was just there right next to Senator Rosenberg when he gave a statement. Steve, we heard the senator there, he sounded very emotional about what he was saying.
He paused for quite a moment there, and I was looking into his eyes, and you could tell he was just on the verge of tears making this statement. It's very heartbreaking for him. He and Brian Hefner have had a relationship for 10 years. They've been very close. Brian Hefner was close to Stan Rosenberg a few years ago when Stan Rosenberg was suffering from cancer. And so they've been close for a long time. And so these allegations are obviously very painful for the Senate president, which he said. Also, as you know, he had indicated, the Senate president indicated that he will be cooperating with the investigation as it goes forward. And but he did not take any questions from the many reporters who were here on hand to hear this statement.
And he did not say anything about stepping down as Senate president, to be clear.
That is correct. He did not say anything about that. We're trying to figure out exactly how the Senate goes about getting this investigation going. Presumably they're going to have to come back. Actually, the Senate, which is in recess really for the rest of the year, may have to, and we're not even certain about this because this is uncharted territory here in the Massachusetts State House. The Senate may have to come back and pass an order in order to create this investigation, to authorize this investigation, and let it go forward. We don't know yet. There was a question as to whether or not there would be a formal session. That question was put to the Senate President's office earlier today, and we were referred to the Senate Majority Leader's office, Harriet Chandler, which her office is right next door to the Senate President's office. She will be overseeing that along with Minority Leader Bruce Tarr. So we don't know exactly the way this is going to roll out, but it will be rolling out over the next couple of weeks.
Steve, one more question for you. I mean, we heard Rosenberg say at the beginning of his statement that he encourages anyone to come forward who feels like they must, that they should have no fear of retaliation, and that the Senate still has a zero tolerance policy for sexual harassment. I mean, he might genuinely feel that way, but what's the mood been on Beacon Hill? I mean, do people feel like anything about the culture is changing in the wake of these revelations?
Well, I think there's definitely a change in the air, but you were talking before the Senate president came out about how this building is sort of unique in that who do you go to? If you come in, if you're not an employee of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, you come in to do business and you encounter something, who do you go to? And the State House is kind of a schizophrenic building because you have the governor in charge of part of the place, you have the Senate president in charge of part of the place, and you have the House Speaker in charge of part of the building as well. So there are a lot of cracks to fall into because, again, it's one building, but there's three different operations going on here. And when problems arise, who do you go to?
Right. Well, that's WBUR State House reporter Steve Brown speaking to us from the State House just outside the Senate President's office, where Senate President Stan Rosenberg just gave a statement about the allegations that his spouse has sexually assaulted at least four men in the past couple of years. Steve, thank you so very much.
Thanks a lot, Megna.
Let's turn back to John Carroll and Tom Keene for their thoughts on what Senator Rosenberg said. Tom, I mean, just 10 minutes ago, we were talking about how you think it's time for Rosenberg to step down. No talk about that from him
whatsoever. No talk about that from him. I think we're going to see this unfold over the next several days. As I was listening to him talk about the investigation, what I was struck by is that the investigation really requires the individuals who say they were harassed to actually come forward or in some fashion speak to the investigators. And you can really see this stopping very quickly if the only two people the investigators can talk to are Rosenberg and Hefner, mm-hmm. and there's nobody else out there. So it's really going to, I'm hopeful that Rosenberg's words that people should feel free to come forward are really taken to heart, and that people are encouraged to come forward on a truly confidential basis.
Right, that's key.
I mean, if their names surface, if they think their names are going to surface, then they're not going to come forward.
John?
Yeah, I think he just opened up the family-sized can of worms here, because he was saying things that are sort of dismissible out of hand. There is not a zero-tolerance policy there. There is not an open process that people should rely on that would shield them from retaliation. And the whole idea of, there was – the firewall was there. There was no influence. He shouldn't have said it. That's the whole point. It doesn't matter whether there was influence or not. The fact that he would go around to people involved in state business in one way or another and say that he had that influence, right.
Yeah.
That's the problem in itself. So I think that there are more questions left unanswered here by Rosenberg's statement than there are answers provided or even any kind of confidence provided about the process going forward.
Right. And just let's remember that a number of these incidents were alleged to happen within close proximity to Rosenberg.
Correct.
While he was engaged in business that one can argue was Senate business.
Well, political business, at least,
well,
yes.
Political business. So that's not much of a firewall.
Hmm. Well, we will see what happens as we figure out exactly how the investigation will unfold. I completely agree with your point, Tom, though, that it's not going to go very far unless the victim can be assured absolute anonymity. So that's, it's interesting times where we're not even entirely sure of that just yet, but we'll see what happens. So Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and regular contributor to WBR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinions page. Thank you, as always.
You're welcome.
You're a good sparring partner on taxes, by the way. I appreciate that. And John Carroll, professor of communications at Boston University and senior analyst for WBUR. It's always great to have you, John, as well.
Always good to be here.
Happy weekend to
Thanks.
Both of you. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, an unlikely figure is the star of an estate auction in Amesbury. The private collection of the late Grande Dame Harriet Gould, member of a historic Yankee family, contains memorabilia, gifts, and works by none other than pop art icon Andy Warhol. Now, in a scene straight out of a movie, the items were found in Gould's attic after she passed away. These items had not been seen for 30 years. The Warhol collection originally belonged to Harriet's son, John Gould, also known as the muse of Warhol's later years. The auction will be continuing through tomorrow, but joining us right now to discuss the finds are Dan Meter, the director at the John McInnes Auctioneers in Amesbury. Dan, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Thomas Sokolowski. He's the former director of the Andy Warhol Museum in Pittsburgh and current director of the Zimmerli Art Museum at Rutgers University. Thomas Sokolowski, welcome to you.
Welcome. Thank you very much.
And I said that wrong. It's Zimmerli, right?
Zimmerli.
My apologies. Well, first of all, Dan, let me just start with you. How significant is this find? Is this auction unseen items from Warhol for 30 years?
Well, it's very significant in that we found some things that were unknown and unusual, atypical of his work. So for us to find that up here in Amesbury, Massachusetts was just, it's an extraordinary thing.
Now, you went through the collection piece by piece as you were discovering it.
It wasn't just a collection. It was the house was very, very full. So I had to pull through to find these things, to pull them out. We knew the relationship that John Gould had with Andy. So we knew that there was potential. He had an art collection. John had an art collection that he had amassed with Andy Warhol, and that was separate from what we were dealing with. We were dealing with the personal effects, the things that were brought back after he passed away, and Harriet stored them away in the house. And in that, we found these treasures.
Okay. Well, we'll talk about exactly what those treasures are in just a minute. But Thomas, I think it's really the story of the relationship between Gould and Warhol, which makes this such an exciting moment. I mean, tell us who John Gould was.
Well, I think it's very interesting, given your past segment, the relationship between Gould and Andy Warhol was extremely chaste on the one hand compared to what we've been hearing the last few weeks in our world. I think it's when you said earlier that Gould was the muse of Andy Warhol in his later years, I think that was really true, because from all the indications we had in the archives in the museum, as well as through Andy's own words in, that were published in his diaries, he really talks openly about his passion and love for John Gould. And we don't really know, because there's nowhere in the archives where there was any indication of whether there was any complete reciprocation, whether any physical activity between the two of them. But Gould certainly lived in Warhol's house for a while, and they went on many trips together. And certainly one of the things that Warhol did when people he was fixated upon would take them out on trips across the world, across the city, and take them to places like Studio 54 or Max's Kansas City earlier, and that these young people, even though John Gould came from a very prominent Yankee family, as you said, never probably in his young days would have gotten in. So it was a wonderful kind of symbiotic use of one another. Gould was provided access, as I said, and Andy Warhol was able to bring in someone young and attractive, and that would always bring any people to his group. And he had done that very similarly back in the 60s with the Gamma, Edie Sedgwick, who also was from an old Yankee as well as California family.
Now, Thomas, if I may, but there's sort of some, as with any relationship like this, there's complexities, right? Because I understand that Gould was not an openly gay man.
No, and in fact, when he, even though at the end of his New York years, he was in the hospital and then recovered, at least for a time period, and then went to Los Angeles, which has always been, particularly in those years, was very closeted out there, from what I'm told. He did not do anything or appear even in groups that would suggest that he was gay or bisexual. And I think the family, subsequent to his death in particular, never admitted to that. And I think it's not uninteresting that this material that was just discovered was sort of hidden away.
Yeah.
I think it was like the purloined letter. The family didn't want this kind of evidentiary material to come out there, although none of it really is at all salacious or even juicy. But, I remember in one of the elements in one of Warhol's time capsules, there was a pillow which had their two, the letters of their first and last names sort of intertwined in embroidery on a pillow.
Mm-hmm.
And I can say that one time when I went through the photographs that remained in the holdings of the Andy Warhol Foundation back 15 years ago, of the 20 or 30,000 photographs that remained, an inordinate number were photographs, Polaroids, etc., of John Gould.
Oh, interesting. Let me jump in here, because I want to turn back to Dan for a moment. Now, Gould died at the very young age of 33 of AIDS-related illness, right? And just what? That was just 6 months prior to Warhol dying.
Yes, right.
So it. Yeah, so in the trove that you found in Gould's mother's house, what about their relationship? What do the items illuminate about the relationship?
I found some things that were very telling, and there was some poetry that John had written to Andy, and what he did was he made photocopies of it before he sent it out to him. And so this would have been when he was in California, and he would send it back over. And they were very compassionate, they were very loving, and they were very, if you got this from your companion or someone that you wanted to be with, you'd be so warmed and so heartened to have these things. And when you look at these, and then you look at some of the things that we found in these artworks, and the aggressive nature of them, it's like you can see that it wasn't a one-way street. I mean, Andy, yes, we all know Andy had this infatuation for John, but it was not a one-way street. We found that in some of these writings. In some of the artwork, like I said, that we found, we see the complexity, though, because they're very aggressive pieces. And I think when he presented them to John, it was really telling of what was going on in Andy's head.
And Thomas, what do you make of that? Does it further your understanding of those last months of Andy Warhol's own life?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, having worked with his works for a long time. But I would say what was interesting, and that I would not be in disagreement with the other gentleman, but it was very interesting that I guess it was the second time that John Gould was in the hospital, and Andy was, not only was he frightened about the AIDS crisis, but he always had a morbid fear of hospitals and death, and that he died of malpractice 6 months later.
Right.
He had something on there. But when he came back in one of the diary entries, he said to his housekeepers, oh, now, cause at that point he had been, before he went to the hospital, John had been living in Andy's townhouse in the east side of Manhattan. He said, oh, make sure you wash his dishes and his laundry separate from mine.
That was in 1984, right. Yeah.
And he just, there was a notion of that, you know, almost had more power for him because of this sort of mortality, which was some of his Byzantine Catholic upbringing. But I think you were right that there was a real fondness there. I mean, almost in a funny kind of way, whether it was ever consummated or not, it reminds me of this film that's being so touted now, Call Me By Your Name.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sort of definitely a lot of
younger and older and flirtation and what have you.
Yeah, so we just got about a minute or so to go. Dan, I wanted to ask you about one of the items which is going to be up for auction. It's the high-value one that you're saying, but it's one that has no peer in the Warhol collection.
Right. It was a new canvas, a stretched canvas that Andy took, and he actually, with force, broke this canvas and formed it into a sculpture and painted it at the same time. So he formed it into this structure that it's very moving. When you look at it, it's a very powerful piece that it makes you think. You look at this and you understand when you realize what was going on in the world of Andy and John, that there was conflict and that there was frustration and there were all of these aggressive behaviors in Andy's mind. So it really is a unique piece that there's nothing that we have seen that has been familiar. So that to us, you know, really, you know, it gave me goosebumps when I found it. When you understand the relationship, it's just like, wow, this is in 1983, right in the middle of what would have ended up as being in the heart of their relationship and all the conflict that was involved. So it was really telling.
Fascinating. And you're estimating that it could be worth $500,000.
Yeah, well, we know his work goes up to $110 million in the past at auction. So it goes down to low thousands all the way up. There's no one that could say we're right or wrong. Well, an auction will determine what it's worth on that day. So
yeah. That's
what we'll find.
Well, Dan Meter is the director at John McInnes Auctioneers in Amesbury. Dan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us. The auction is tomorrow at 1 p.m.
And Dan's helping us tell the story of this amazing trove of Andy Warhol-related items found in a house in Amesbury. Thomas Sokolowski is the former director of the Andy Warhol Museum in Pittsburgh and currently the director of the Zimmerle Art Museum at Rutgers. Thomas Sokolowski, thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a nice afternoon.
Well, finally today, a little science, because research is showing ocean water is becoming increasingly acidic, including Boston Harbor. At the Institute of Contemporary Art in Boston, one artist is showing visitors how this change is affecting a tiny little organism that gives us half of our oxygen. Here's WBUR arts reporter Maria Garcia.
Artist Evelyn Britt stands in the lobby of the ICA holding a green popsicle.
I want to offer you a phytoplankton popsicle.
Phytoplankton are these super tiny plant-like organisms that live at the surface of the ocean. They create half of the atmosphere's oxygen and are the base of the ocean's food web. So these little green things are super important and, according to Ritz, good enough to eat on the popsicle she made.
I'm dipping the popsicle in lemon juice, and then inspired by Boston Harbor water, I'm dipping it here in Atlantic sea salt. So it's a little salty, a tiny bit fishy. It's very good for you.
I expected it to taste really badly.
I really like it.
Good.
Ritz, who grew up in Miami, has been kind of obsessed with the ocean since she was a kid. In her art, she draws and photographs objects she's found washed up on coastlines throughout the U.S., from rope to refrigerators. She tries to show how water is the common thread of humanity. The ocean, so fierce, sometimes threatening, powerful, but also fragile, vulnerable to our human activity. It holds our histories, our migrations, our wars.
I think it is a site both of complex histories and of politically charged, historically charged. The ocean is such a complex place for everything from thinking about immigration to plastic washing up on the shore to long histories of travel, of migration, both wanted and unwanted.
Now at the ICA, Ritz is bringing light to the change in phytoplankton at the surface of the Boston Harbor, just outside the museum. She put them on popsicles to get people to really think about phytoplankton, the opposite of out of sight, out of mind.
The popsicles are a way to kind of to consume them, to make them part of your memory, part of your experience.
The popsicle is purposely sour, representing how much our oceans are souring. Data from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration shows that carbon dioxide humans are putting in the atmosphere isn't just warming our planet, it's also making our oceans acidic.
There's some research showing over time, some phytoplankton will go extinct and others will thrive. So we don't know exactly how it'll affect everything, but we do know it's changing ocean chemistry and creating an imbalance.
Ritz wants people to explore this change through artistic methods. At her installation, visitors use pH paper strips and different acidic liquids, including water from the Boston Harbor, to make what look like abstract paintings. Here's Abigail Purvis, a museum visitor.
It's just interesting to know that, like, there's something, like, the water in the Boston Harbor is, like, intense enough. It's already at a stage where it's intense enough to, like, we can see it change visually.
All the paintings then hang together on a large wall at the ICA, their bluish-green tones resembling the color of the harbor's water outside the museum.
Looking back to these small individual gestures, these small drops on the page, one individual's actions becoming part of a much larger public environment. Just like our private individual actions are become part of a shared public space and they have bigger impacts.
Impacts that Ritz's art has an unconventional and powerful way of illustrating. Her installation is open at the ICA on weekend afternoons until mid-March.
That report from WBUR's Maria Garcia. And I'm so happy we got to end this crazy week with that kind of story. It's a science piece hidden within an arts report because, honestly, here at Radio Boston, we believe there's no bright line between the two, between science and art. It's all beautiful and wondrous to us. And I can say that because our show is produced by a bunch of Renaissance men and women, Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, Allison Bruzek. We had help from Cassandra Sunt and Zoe Mitchell. Tim Skog is our technical/artistic director, and we had help today from Renee Marchando. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Have a wonderful weekend. Join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.